This is the Davis and Beadle Podcast.
All right, it's time for the Davis and Beadle Podcast. I'm Davis, he's Beadle. It's been a while, Beadle, with moving and everything. So how are you doing? How are things over in the Front Range?
Things are good, yeah. We're a busy people, you and I. So it's hard to get together sometimes, I guess.
I know. Well, hopefully we'll get back into kind of a regular routine here. But moved a couple of weeks ago, and it's love the new house and everything. It just when you've lived in one place for 22 years, there's a lot of decisions to make in terms of what you keep, what you get rid of, and just other things when you buy a house that you didn't plan on having to deal with. But it's been great, and been some challenges, some hurdles. But it sounds like you've been all over the place. What you went out to Phoenix. And then you came back and watched your son Colton. And I just think this is so cool. Getting his first varsity baseball experience. And it's an important moment for any kid to get to do that, play a varsity baseball game. But where he got to do it, tell us more about it, because that's pretty special. That's an incredible memory.
Yeah, pretty cool. I think it's Chassa that you set these that you can set these games up through. They're called Foundation Games, and there's a handful of teams that get to play every year, but they get to play at Coors Field, and it doesn't count towards their overall record or anything. And it's partially a fundraiser, partially just a cool experience for the kids. But yeah, Severance High School played Rocky Mountain at Coors Field on Tuesday, and yeah, that was my son's very first varsity experience. So I was like, dude, you can't do any better than that. If you're gonna get called up to play varsity for the day, then doing it at Coors Field is an awesome experience. And it was too, it was just a cool experience for everybody, parents, players, officials, everything. That's a neat deal to be able to be involved in that. But yeah, really cool to see those kids out there on the big field, and it's a memory they'll have for you'll have that anyway, but just to add that to it is really pretty spectacular little thing for those kids and everybody to see that. Yeah, that was a special day. It's a lot of hours spent coaching and doing things, and you get payoffs like that to make it worth it.
What did he say about getting to play at Coors Field and now he has bragging rights over you? Because you didn't get to play Coors Field, and he has, so he's got bragging rights over the old man.
I've never played there, so he does definitely has bragging rights. The main thing he said was they need to water the infield a little bit. his pinch running debut, ended with a slide into second base. He's like, dude, it was rock hard. So they need some water. But
it's okay. Field conditions at Coors Field. Yeah, yeah. Okay. Field conditions are, they'll leave something to be desired. That's great.
No, he loved it. They got to, they got to go check out the locker rooms and warm up on the field and all that stuff. And so, just being in those dugouts is a totally different vibe when you have that giant dugout and all the amenities that you have. It's a little better than your chain link metal aluminum bench that you freeze your tail off on in March and April around here. So I think that was just pretty special right there, just to have a venue like that to hang out on, and just the giant scoreboard that has the lineups and logos and all that stuff. Pretty cool. You get your name announced, all that stuff. Just the whole experience, really fun for them.
Now, did they have an espresso machine in the dugout like the Italian World Baseball Classic team had? Because they had an espresso machine.
I don't know if they did or not, but that sounds pretty awesome to me.
Yeah.
Like, I didn't used to be a coffee drinker, but I've been pretty heavy into the coffee now for a few years, so I'm down. I'm all for it.
Yeah, forget Powerade, Gatorade, go the route of the Italians and have an espresso machine in the dugout. So speaking of the world,
a little revved up.
And get really, really amped up. I take you watched some of the World Baseball Classic Championship game, Japan and the U.S. last night.
Yeah, I watched a good portion of it, and yeah, that was fun. That was pretty cool.
Almost seemed, it just almost like it was scripted out, right? It was going to be Ohtani, it was going to be Trout, and Joe Davis. So I think Joe Davis does a great job. It was saying fifth inning. Hey, Ohtani might come in and pitch in relief, and he might face his old teammate Mike Trout, and wouldn't that be something? And that's what ends up happening when the two face each other in the ninth inning, and Ohtani gets a strikeout. I mean, it's his first save since he played in the professional leagues in Japan. I just really enjoyed it. The excitement of when they played Cuba in the semifinals, obviously playing in Miami with the huge Cuban population that's there, that was fun to see. But just the U.S. look, here's the thing that I think you have to think about. And this is not meant to diminish the talent of Samurai Japan, of the Japanese baseball team, because it's a super talented group of guys. And baseball at the professional level in Japan is it's top shelf stuff. But the fact that you don't have a Gerrit Cole, a Max Scherzer, you've got, no offense to Kyle Freeland, but the Kyle Freelands of the world and the Merrill Kellys and guys like that are pitching in the World Baseball Classic for Team USA doesn't put you in the best position to win baseball games. And they really had to ride their offense, that lineup with Schwarber and company, and obviously Trey Turner had a really, really phenomenal World Baseball Classic run. But I just think when you don't have your best pitchers pitching, and I know Kershaw wanted to, but there was some insurance hang-up snafu that kept him from pitching. When you don't have the best arms, best American arms playing on Team USA, it's kind of tough to win it all, isn't it?
Yeah, but, we've talked about this before and how razor thin the margins really are at that level, especially with those countries that you're talking about, with the Americans, the Japanese, Dominicans, Cubans, Venezuelans. They're all that good. They really are. I mean, it's, and I agree with you. If you got a Max Scherzer or a Gerrit Cole or somebody like that to start that game, maybe it goes a little bit different, but man, the margins are so thin, and the differences in those guys is just not that much in the end, from a standpoint of talent. And it's hard to say who would have produced more. I know one thing: the passion and emotion that was played with for everybody throughout the tournament, you can't deny that. And you can't deny that guys up their game for that kind of level of play. And when you're playing for your country, it means something a little bit different to everybody, from the standpoint of playing for your country. But to hear the comments and to see the emotion and the passion in those games, I don't think it really mattered in the end. I mean, you're getting everybody's best no matter what, and they're already the best players in the world. So, it's just, I thought it was pretty cool from the standpoint of, they had a fantastic offensive lineup, and then you got to showcase the fact that you can still play at that level even without those very top names. So that's kind of cool. You might remember guys like Merrill Kelly and guys like that a little bit more as you go into the season, and so. Guys that you didn't really have on your radar before, they might be on it a little bit more now, but it's hard to say whether they would have produced more or less, but obviously both those teams got to the final. They were kind of the favorites at the start, along with the Dominican team. That was a fantastic team as well. So, I think it played out the way people expected for the most part, regardless of who was on the rosters, but I was just super impressed with, the fact that you have all these changes, rule changes in Major League Baseball. They did not install them for World Baseball Classic. No. Nobody really noticed, and so I think if you're Major League Baseball, you take a hard look at that, not to say that the rule changes that you've made aren't valuable, because a 182 game season is a lot different than a 20 game tournament. So I get that, but, you should take a look at that if you're Major League Baseball and say, why was there so much passion involved in these games, and why did nobody care whether anybody shifted or the bases were bigger or whether there was a pitch clock and all that stuff? And it goes back to what I've said and we've talked about for a long time, which is you have to have games that matter more. Just find a way to make it matter more. So if that means maybe looking at your playoff setup a little bit differently or more regional games, I don't know what the answer is. You know, in the minor leagues, you get a first half winner and a second half winner. Maybe that'll make things matter more early for teams if you had something like that when it comes down to it. So I think that's really the lesson to take from it is nobody asked or said anything about the rules. They just wanted to see the games. And there were some awesome moments. That grand slam from Trey Turner in the semifinal game. I was at a bar in Phoenix. I know you're shocked that I was at a bar.
Really?
There was basketball and baseball on the TV because it was in the middle of the NCAA tournament too. And so there was lots of people watching lots of different stuff. That place erupted when Trey Turner hit that grand slam. And I haven't seen that when it comes to baseball for a long time, unless you're talking about the World Series and you're in a hometown type of situation, right? I just haven't seen that before for baseball, and it was incredible. It was so cool to experience that. So, you know, I think it was a super fun atmosphere, and Major League Baseball should look at that and go, how did we do that? and figure it out and try to add some of that to their regular season.
Yeah, and I think there's merit to the first half, second half idea that you brought up. I really do. One of the things that came up last night was about Shohei Ohtani, who came out of the pen to get the save, gets the strike out of Mike Trout, and the incredible matchup of the two Los Angeles Angels teammates. And John Schmoltz had made a comment, I'm going to kind of paraphrase here a little bit, of probably at some point Ohtani's going to have to decide whether he's going to focus on being a hitter in baseball, or he's going to focus on being a starting pitcher. That it feels like that probably it's tough to continue that dual life that he's leading as a DH and also as a starting pitcher. And I tend to agree with the Buckeye boy. We're talking about it on our show today, that let Shohei Ohtani decide when it's time to maybe focus on one or the other. And he's already done it longer than Babe Ruth did when he was at the Boston Red Sox. And so let Ohtani make that decision. Cause I mean, you look at the numbers. I mean, this last year, obviously had an incredible offensive year, particularly in terms of hitting home runs, but he had a fantastic ERA. He was clearly the LA Angels' best pitcher. And, maybe if he ends up going someplace where he's not the guy on the bump, if he's your second or third guy in your rotation, and now there's a universal DH, so that opens up the entire baseball universe to him in terms of what teams he could go to. I just think that don't you let him decide that when if the numbers start to bear out that, hey, look, 3 years down the road, the numbers start to really drop and that then becomes an issue, then okay, then you cross that bridge when you get to it. And I get it. The past, he's been hurt, the first couple of years with the Los Angeles Angels. Last year, he was healthy, and man, look how good he was. You'd like to think that that's where he's trending now. And I just think, don't you let him make that decision? I mean, obviously, it's carefully monitored, and the numbers are looked at and evaluated, but don't you let him decide when to hang up one or the other?
I would, and I guess I go back to the fact that, he's doing something that we really don't know anything about. You see it a little bit at the college level, not much anymore, but a little bit here and there. But that's a 50-game schedule, right? So you can make that work for that short of a period of time. Obviously, you see it all the time at the high school and youth levels. I mean, kids play two ways, all of them. They all do. So it's weird because we don't really know anything about it, but we should, because we do it all the time with kids when they're younger. And I just don't think, when it comes to value, to me, that's the question is, are you getting your best value out of him? So if that means that he pitches, once every seven games instead of once every five games, okay, that's fine.
Yeah.
If that means that he moves to the bullpen in a different role at some point, that's fine. But when it comes to value right now, I'll take a dude that throws 100 with the
101
slider I've seen for a while. and I'll take a dude that'll hit 40 bombs and run. What did he run, a 4.19 the first last night or something?
Oh, it's insane. I mean, as big as he is to leg it out, and you're just going, holy smokes. How does that guy do that?
How do you not want to watch that? That's what I'm saying. I get where Smolty's coming from when he's like looking into the future, and that's great. That's kind of his job, is to project stuff out. But how the hell would you not want to watch this? Like, as long as you possibly can, do it. You're going to make $500 million here real soon. So you don't have to worry about money. He already doesn't have to worry about money, but he's going to really not have to worry about
really
any of that.
Not going to be a problem
from the standpoint of longevity. Who cares about longevity? Dude, do what you're doing for as long as you can do it. And if your body tells you that you can't anymore, then you listen to your body. But I wouldn't listen to the businessmen in the room, and I wouldn't listen to the owners and GMs in the room. They have nothing but greed in their minds, and not a malicious type of greed. A greed just that they want to make you last as long as they possibly can and get the most out of you for the money that they're paying you. All right. So you got to understand that if you're a ball player at any level. But if you're Shohei Ohtani, you're not in a position where you have to worry about your next contract. There is nobody like him. You're going to get paid massive amounts of money. What I would worry about if I was Ohtani is, how do I maybe move to the next stage of this, which is, all right, I've proven I can do it. Now let's figure out what is the best schedule to do it on. There's, like you said, universal DH, so you don't have to worry about which league you're in anymore. What's the best schedule to do this on? Should I be a starter? Should I be a reliever? What should it be? Do I need to play a position or just be a DH? How's this going to work to where I get to do this as long as I can possibly do it? And that should be really where their mindset is, if you ask me. If you're Shohei Ohtani, is let's look at some data here and figure out what is the best type of schedule for me to operate
right
on. Well, and I'll then
just
do it.
Well, just going back to last night. I mean, there was the comment from Schmaltz, and there's truth to it that he hadn't come out of the bullpen, and I think he picked up a save when he was playing in the Japanese league years ago. And so, that's an unfamiliar role to him. Like, comes in last night, gets the save, strikes out one of the best hitters in baseball in his teammate, Mike Trout. I think Shohei Ohtani can probably figure out how to pitch out of the bullpen. I don't think that's going to be a big issue for him if that's ultimately what they decided to do to save on wear and tear, that kind of thing. But it's you're right. It's finding what is the plan for him? What's the schedule? Like you said, does he pitch every 7 days? Is he a bullpen guy? And because you don't want to take his bat out of the lineup, you sure the hell don't want to do that. And you really don't want to take his arm out of however you want to use him, as a starter or as a bullpen guy. So I just think, my opinion is very much let him go until he says, I can't do this anymore physically or mentally, or the numbers start to go, now's the time to just be one or the other. And I think let's enjoy it as long as it lasts, because who knows, we'll ever see this again. A guy like Ohtani doing what he's doing. It's unlikely we'll ever see it again.
Yeah, and it's interesting too, because you think about it from a managerial side of things. If you're the manager of whatever team he's on, who knows how long he's going to be on the Angels, and who knows where he's going to end up. But if you're the manager of that team, like, I think about it the way I would attack a 12U baseball tournament. I want my best player to affect as many games as possible.
Absolutely.
If I can. And obviously being safe with them as well. You don't want to wear guys out. But so maybe the bullpen makes more sense. And that's why I say you kind of have to climb into the data and see, like, okay, over a season, he has 25 starts on the mound. How many games did he truly affect as that pitcher versus if he had 40 or 50 relief appearances? Does he affect games more or less by doing that? You know, do we limit his actual total innings pitched as a starter or as a reliever? And, you know, obviously in this day and age, relievers just don't throw as many innings as they used to. So, you know, you're gonna shorten his workload of innings if he's a reliever, but you've got to figure out how to use your, I mean, if he's your best guy, which he's going to be pretty much everybody's best guy, how do we have him affect as many games as possible and still keep that bat and the defender that he is too. So, you know, it's hard to sit here and say exactly what to do, because like I said, just haven't seen this at this level. So, you know, I think in the end, you know, the guy is kind of a unicorn anyway. You're not going to see, you might see a little trend here because I think, you know, it's going to be popular for a lot of kids now coming through the system that will be like, yeah, I can do both. Whereas they weren't really allowed to do that over the last few decades, right? Like you just had to pick one at right. some point. I can't think, you know, there's guys like Darren Dreifert was a two-way player, a big time two-way player in college. They basically told him, look, you're just going to have to pitch because that's your best skill, right? And then there's been others, but they just didn't really allow it. And now the door's open and there's leverage for people to say, look, this guy did it. I want to do it too.
But you got to be as good as he is though, Beetle. That's the thing is, and how, I mean, this last season, that's a lot to ask. I mean, one of the best ERAs in baseball. He was one of the leading home run hitters in baseball. It's one thing to go out and try to do both. It's one thing to go out and do it as well as he did it last year. And now the challenge becomes, is this become the norm for him? Is he one of the top five hitters in baseball and one of the top five pitchers, starting pitchers in baseball? It'll be fun to watch, see how it goes. You're right, but it's going to start a trend. But I don't know if we're going to see guys that can match that kind of production.
Yeah.
That'll try to do it, but we'll see. Major League Baseball, leading up, of course, to the start of the season, announced some tweaks in regard to some of the rules with, you know, if there was an issue with PitchCom and things like that. One thing kind of caught my eye. We never think about bat boys and bat girls, right? Unless they blow up, you know, hot shot ground ball or something in foul territory or whatever the case may be. Well, there's now new standards for bat boys and bat girls that they're going to be gauged on their ability to retrieve equipment and help efforts to speed up the game. That the league will evaluate their performances and could ask teams to replace them if their performance is considered substandard. And it reminds me of that episode on Seinfeld where Kramer wants to be like a ball shagger at the U.S. Open
or whatever. Ball boy.
And he's out there and he's all these you know, teenage kids are doing it. And here's Kramer. It's like, so this is how far this has gone that now we're micromanaging every single aspect. Like, and I'm all in favor of games moving along in a more expedient fashion, but this is getting a little crazy where I'm sorry, Jeff, but you know, your time out there going to pick up that bat was a little slow. You know, the last three games, I'm sorry, we're kicking you to the curb. I just read that and I'm going, really? Now they're evaluating the bat boys and bat girls for what they do? Okay. I just think it's just getting kind of ridiculous now.
I hadn't heard that until right now. So, I mean, get over yourself, MLB. What are we doing? I mean, why would you even consider that to be part of the equation when it comes to
I know.
Fan experience and stuff like that? Not one time have I ever given even two thoughts to who that, like, maybe the only thought I ever give to the bat boys is, I get that gig, that's awesome. Like,
well, Dusty Baker's kid nearly getting ran over at the plate, right? Which saw he's in spring training now. It's hard to believe things move that quick, but
yeah,
you know, and then was it JT Snow had to grab him out of the way at the plate or something like that. But that's like the only time, right? And it was also because he was Dusty Baker's kid, but still it would have been a story. But that's it. I mean, I just didn't realize that the Major League Baseball was so focused on every aspect of speeding a game up, including evaluating the bat boys and bat girls. And kicking them out if they're not doing their job as quickly as Major League Baseball thinks they should.
It's ridiculous, first of all. I mean, I can't even believe that we're talking about it.
I know. I was looking through this. I'm going, what?
Yeah.
I'm okay.
I truly hate the pitch clock stuff. I despise it. But it is working. For whatever purpose they wanted it to fill in speeding up the game, it's working. Okay. Right. The games are definitely longer. I mean, definitely shorter. And there's a little bit more offense. They've proven that so far with the pitch clock and the no shifting and all that stuff. So they've kind of accomplished their task. So I hope crap like that just disappears and they go, yeah, okay, we don't really need to look at that. We've kind of accomplished what we set out.
We're fine. Your games are, you know, 2.5 hours, 2:45. We're good.
Yeah. Yeah. So, I mean, it's silly to think that somebody brought that forth in a meeting and somebody else went, yeah.
Yeah, I've been noticing that the bat boys and bat girls have been a real problem. They're really slow, and we need to look at that. We could chop off like 2 seconds off every game if they were more efficient at what they're
doing.
Yeah, it's just stupid.
It makes you sound like a total Mr.
Jackass, is what it's
curmudgeon.
So I've noticed the problem with the bat boys and the bat girls. Yes, you have, Mr. Manfred. Okay. Let's wrap it up here with some NCAA basketball talk. A high roller like you, I know you're busy, but did you get a chance to go to watch any of the games of Ball Arena? Were you courtside? I didn't see you, but when I was watching on the tube.
I was not. We were in Phoenix, so
okay,
I was,
so you
I was
were there
not
the whole time.
There, but did not see any of the games of Ball Arena with my own two eyes, except for on TV, so I did notice, though, like, give Denver credit. I don't know whether it's the town or whether it was the you know, choice of teams that were there.
Like in Zaga.
That place was packed. Yeah, it was packed every night. Every game was pretty well packed. And some of these arenas, you look around and you're like, where's the folks? Where are they at?
You know, like, it's a basketball tournament. Why wouldn't you be here?
Yeah. I mean, one of my fondest memories of sports at anything was going to the NCAA basketball tournament when I was, I think I was a freshman or sophomore in high school, and I went to the Salt Lake City region. They were playing at Weber State's gym, and I watched the first round, and it was, you know, teams I had no clue about, but I will never forget it. It was so much fun, and it was an unbelievable atmosphere with the bands and the mascots and the team. Obviously there were some upsets. That was the year Jason Kidd was at Cal and they got upset by Wisconsin Green Bay. And I will never forget it. It was spectacular. And the fact that they can't fill some of these arenas is either a price problem, which is probably what it is.
Yeah.
Or it's just they've gone to the point where the coverage of everything is just too good. You know what I mean? Like,
right.
Like why go? I can watch what I need to watch and stay up with the scores and all that stuff. I don't know. It's hard to say that the coverage is too good because it's a national event. So it has to be good. But I mean, I'm guessing for the most part, it's price. I mean, it's expensive to go to those things and it shouldn't be that bad. Like that is your marquee event if you're the NCAA, period. Not the bowl championships and football, but this. The NCAA basketball tournament is your marquee event for the entire year. And if you've made it so unaffordable that people don't show up and fill your arenas, you're failing. So I think that was an interesting thing that I drew from watching.
I did read something in the Post today that if the Broncos somewhere down the road decide to build a dome stadium, that Denver would immediately, which, you know, it's, you know, Ball Arena, it's almost 20,000, but now it's got to be bigger, right? You got to have a larger seating capacity.
Yeah.
That Denver would be up for a Final Four if the Broncos ever build a dome stadium.
Yeah.
So we'll see if that happens down the road.
we all know Denver's a great sports town. I mean, that's for sure. It has been for a long time. But obviously, I think the real allure is it's kind of the middle of things again. You know, when you look at being able to travel to a place, you're never too far away from Denver, really. I mean, obviously, if you're all the way to the East Coast and Florida and stuff like that, all right, that's a pretty good job. But man, if you're even in the Midwest and the east side of the Midwest, it's really not too bad to get to Denver, and the West Coast is all within reach. So that's a huge part of it too, I think, for some of those regions. And you know, when you stick a team coming from across the country that nobody knows about, you know, in a region in North Carolina or something like that, that's not to beat up on North Carolina. It's just that they don't know those teams and they're not going to get a bunch of travel there. But Denver's pretty easy to get to for the most part. And there's a reason it's growing like mad. And there's a reason that there's a lot of different fans in Denver. There's a lot of transplants. And so it's a good sports town from that standpoint. We all know that. And I think that's probably the biggest key is, you know, if they have the venue, I think, yeah, you're right. They're going to be a top contender for stuff like that. So
yeah. You okay after this week? I mean, Duke loses in both the men's and women's tournament. Duke women lose to Colorado. I know how much you love the Buffs. So you okay this week? You all right?
I'm fine. All of that pales in comparison to the empty locker room that resides in Laramie right now with the mass exodus of their entire basketball team. There's only two kids left. Two.
You got some eligibility, don't you? Right? Come on, don't you still have some eligibility left? You could, you know, you played City Rec hoops. You played high school. They'd probably welcome you in.
I could get up and down the floor once, twice, maybe before I needed a break.
I think they might need a little more than that.
I don't want to get too deep into it, but the transfer portal has absolutely destroyed so many programs on a year-to-year basis, and people will figure it out. It'll catch up. It'll catch up. You know, there's just a lot of weird stuff going on right now with transfer portal and NIL and stuff like that. But to have an entire team pretty much hit the portal, and I mean, to only have two scholarship guys on your roster,
that's not good. Point in the year, unfortunate.
Is unbelievable.
Yeah. All right, let's wrap it up here with Chris Hanks. You're going to go watch when the Mavericks play Calvary Christian. And he's at $9.99. Give me your thoughts about that. I mean, that's success. That's deep runs every year to super regionals and World Series. And I mean, that's just remarkable of him winning 999 games. I did ask him who they beat his first game as a head coach at Mesa. And it was Southern Utah in tournament, I think I might have been in St. George, or I can remember where they were playing, but
was there.
You were there. So what was that? I mean, what's your memory of that when Chris won his first one?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I do. I remember it very well. We were in St. George, Utah. We played Southern Utah. And I think if I remember correctly, I believe Derek Corbett maybe was on the mound for that one, either Derek Corbett or TJ Gilpatrick, one of the two. But I remember getting that win because it was, the start. We fought pretty hard to have Coach Hanks be the head coach. I don't, you know, there's Coach Joe Giratano was there. He left to go to Air Force in 1998. And so Chris took over in 1999, but there was this, you know, period where there was no coach and there was going to be a search for a coach, and you know, which is typical, obviously, right?
Sure.
But there was I remember we signed, you know, the entire team signed a letter and a statement to the athletic director at the time and said, this is who we want as a team. Like, we understand you're going to do what you do. And Chris wasn't very, he wasn't like super ingrained yet. He was coaching a little football. Still, he had only been with the program two or three years, I think, as the you know, the hitting coach. Chris was not at that time anyway. You know, he's not a Mesa alum. He is now. I think he's gotten degrees and stuff from Mesa now. But at that time, he wasn't. You know, he was coming off of a professional career from Boston and stuff like that. And so he was kind of working his way through getting degrees and all that stuff. So it's not like Chris was the overly qualified person that he is now. And so I remember fighting for him to be the head coach. That's what we wanted as players. And so that was a big deal to get that first win. And that weekend was a really good weekend. I think we won 3 out of 4 that weekend. I got one of those wins on the mound as well. I think I got win number 3 on the season for him. But it felt like things had changed from a cultural standpoint. And it felt really good to be on a squad that had this feeling of great things are about to happen. And I think we went 42-17 or something like that year. We were, if I remember correctly, the number one seed in the region that year. And things have changed a lot over the years. I was in the Western region, and you could just feel a big difference. And to still see that going on and to see so many teams have that same kind of feeling is amazing. And the fact that he won 1,000 games in 25 years is incredible, off the charts. Like, that's almost impossible what he's done. So,
well, it just speaks to what he's put together there, the culture that he's built, and you were there early on for that. And so guys of your era, you, Jay Cuff, guys like that deserve credit for being the ones that said, hey, we think this guy should be our coach. And it's turned out to be one of the best decisions then Mesa State, now Colorado Mesa's, probably ever made when it comes to athletics. It certainly is up there near the top. Hey, Beadle, if you go over and you see Chris and the guys and he gets 1,000, I'm sure I'll send him a text or something, but send my best to Chris when he gets win number 1,000. Not that's something that guy ever focuses on, things like individual accomplishments. Yeah. That's not something that really focuses on, but still something that needs to be acknowledged and applauded.
Absolutely. I'm looking forward to it. I'm going to make every effort to be there for that win. And yeah, I would be my honor to be there for number 1 and number 1,000. That would be pretty incredible.
All right. Until next time, it's the Davis and Beadle Podcast.
This is the Davis and Beadle Podcast.